Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Today we're going to chat with author Stephen Merlino, and we're going to talk about his book, Jack of Souls. Hi, Stephen.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Welcome to the show. Why don't you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your background?
Okay, great. Well, I live in Seattle, Washington. I grew up here, moved away for a while, but ended up coming back. I started writing in high school and college, mostly just for friends, and eventually started taking it seriously. I had a professor who said, saw a story I wrote and said, wow, you should try to get that published. And as it turns out, he didn't know what he was talking about, but I took him seriously and tried to turn it into a novel, and I did. And from there, just kept going and took it more seriously as I got older. Now I'm 50 years old and have my first novel out, and I'm about to release my second novel, which is called, or will be called, The Knave of Souls.
Interesting. So you're going to go through the whole deck of cards?
Well, I suppose I could if I live long enough and as long as the story stays interesting to me. But yeah, I've got three cards right now in the deck that I've basically already written, at least in first draft, and I'm almost done with the second draft of The Knave of Souls, which should put me on track for getting it out this fall. And The Prince of Souls is in rough draft form. So once I get The Knave out, I'll start on The Prince and start revising it and working it up a little bit.
I have a lot of writers, young writers, that are new, that listen into the show. Why don't you tell them a little bit about how you got started writing a novel? Did you start writing short stories for online or on magazines, or how did you start?
That's an interesting question. I've met a lot of people recently who are short story writers, and that seems to be how they are mastering their craft and getting into writing. I recently submitted a short story called The Jack of Souls also, which is it's basically chapter zero for The Jack of Souls, the novel. I went back and wrote sort of what happened the hour before the novel starts, and in short story form, and I submitted it to Writers of the Future, which is a wonderful contest for anyone who is writing short stories and trying to break into the writing community, because it is a free contest and it is huge. I won a spot in the contest this year. Each year they have four quarters, and you submit, and they choose three winners from each quarter. So there's a total of 12, and they take you down. The prize is this: they take you down to LA for a week, and there's a workshop down there in which big time writers, like we had David Farland, also known as David Wolverton, and Tim Powers, Orson Scott Card showed up, Larry Niven was there, and they all either are with you each day giving you workshops on writing, or they do a 1 hour lecture. Nancy Kress was among them. And it was amazing. And when it's all done, they have a big gala, and they fly you back home with your award, and then they put your story in an anthology. Every year it comes out. It's called the Writers of the Future Anthology. This was volume 32, excuse me. And it gives you huge exposure and wonderful learning experience. Plus, I have these other 12 writers or 11 writers who are now part of my, sort of writing cohort. But to get back to the original point, that's a great way to start as a contest to launch you into, short story writing. But I didn't start with short stories. Actually, that story was the first short story I had ever written. I did it to get into that contest. And I sort of conceived of the story as, it occurred to me, having written novels, that chapter one of a novel bears a lot of similarities to a short story in terms of the kind of economy with which you need to write. You can't do any laborious descriptions. Everything has to be very succinct, and because you have a limited number of pages, and you need to get it all told in that time. Plus, it needs to hook early and resolve comparatively early, you know, in like 6,000 words or whatever. So I wrote that short story for it, but that wasn't what I did. That's not how I learned to write. I learned to write in long form by writing novels and rewriting them again, and then going on to a new novel and writing that, and then revising it. And that process was how I came into writing. And I kind of learned the craft of, you know, dialogue and description and being economical and point of view and all of that stuff. So I guess there's lots of paths to the top of the same mountain. But if you're doing the short story route, that seems to be the way a lot of people get their foot in the door and master the craft. One of the great things about short story writing is it's so much more gratifying, much more quickly, because you finish so much more quickly. You have a finished product, and you know, novels take a long time to write, and so you don't get that gratification the same way. There are other things about novel writing that make it more gratifying for me anyway, which is that I can develop a character much more. I can build a world much more completely, and so on. But yeah, short story writing is a really good way to go, because, you know, even especially if you screw up, you can just chuck it and start a new one. It's not like you've invested that much time in it, you know. So that whereas if you write a novel and it sucks, you've put a lot of time into that, and so you're much less likely just to scrap it. You might just struggle through it some more. And still, though, that has value too. That's how you get mileage on your pen, and you kind of work through a lot of the issues of craft. That's
now,
a long answer.
It is, but that's okay. What is your who's your favorite author, and did they give you inspiration to start writing?
Well, I have two answers to that, I guess. I'll tell you my favorite writer. You know, I spent a master's degree and a lot of time in undergrad studying Shakespeare, because I just love, he's the one of the first fantasy writers and one of the greatest writers ever. And one of the great things about his writing is, you know, the world he lived in is so different from ours that there's a whole other layer of world building going on there, which is Elizabethan England and all the nuances of the way they talked, but also the things they believed and the things that were commonplace to them, which are bizarre to us. And those things just light my imagination up. And I love that, you know, idea, just little things like the idea that souls, people tended to die at the change of a tide. For instance, when the tide starts to go out, that's when, if someone's on their deathbed, that's probably when they're going to die, you know? So they would have these just unusual little ideas that you never run into anymore because they don't exist. And for me, that really fuels my imagination. And so I love Shakespeare for that reason, you know, and it's so funny too. His characters are so funny, and his characters are so richly developed. It gives me a kind of model. You know, Falstaff and Hamlet are my two favorite characters. Modern-wise, right now I'm really enjoying books by Lois McMaster-Bujold. She has a series called The Curse of Chalion series, and it's the first book is called The Curse of Chalion, and I adore the way she handles relationships and plot, and it is the world building is wonderful. I think I go back to that book frequently and listen to it when I go on walks on an audiobook, or I'll study it. I have a copy that's all marked up. The first page is all marked up because she handles the opening of that novel so carefully and so precisely and economically. Everything is just happening. It doesn't bog down, but you just feel drawn into the character and the world, and man, it's just, it's masterful. So I really like Lois McMaster Bujold right now, but there's quite a few writers that will inspire me that way. She just happens to be one that I'm really enjoying right now.
This is going to be a strange question, but is there any fandom that you are a fan of, like Star Wars, Star Trek, Harry Potter, anything like that? It doesn't have to be science fiction. Just murder mysteries or fantasy or anything.
Well, when you say fandom, I don't go to Harry Potter conferences or anything like that.
No, I don't mean that.
Harry
I just
Potter.
Mean a fan.
Yeah. I'm a huge fan of Harry Potter. And in fact, I was thinking of having a Harry Potter trivia night at one of our local cafes. I just got a Trivial Pursuit about Harry Potter that would be fun to, you know, host a thing some night at one of the cafes near my house. I love the Sherlock series, the BBC Sherlock with Cumberbatch.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's good stuff. It's good storytelling.
They're both brilliant, Tim and Martin.
Yeah. And some of those shows, in fact, one of the things I learned about short story writing and writing in general is from that show, there were a couple episodes that absolutely haunted me afterwards and just stayed in my imagination. And as I thought about why, I realized, and the two I'm thinking of are the season-ending one from last year where he jumps off the roof and dies. And then
that
other
was
one...
actually 4 years ago. They just reshowed
it. Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. God,
they kept us hanging with him hanging on the in the air for 4 years. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, see, it still seems fresh in my mind. And the other one was the one called The Woman, or, you know, the one with the kind of dominatrix woman. And the reason they stuck with me, I figured out, was because the writing at the end, or in this case, the cinematography or whatever, did not give me enough to know exactly what happened. And I had to go back. It would be the equivalent of having to reread the last page over and over to try to put something together. It wasn't badly written. It was carefully written in such a way that I was just grasping at straws to put together some kind of meaning there. And they gave me enough to put some kind of meaning together, but not enough for me to be completely satisfied so I could just close the book and forget about it. And as a result, it just haunted me, and my imagination kept turning over the clues in those last moments of the show to try to figure out what the heck happened.
And that is where fan fiction was born. That is why people write fan fiction, because a TV show will do, like, and they'll leave you, sometimes, especially if it's a British show, for a while, hanging, literally, in Sherlock's case, in the midair, and you're trying to figure out what on earth, and the funny thing about the producers of Sherlock is that they pay attention to the fan fiction. They read it. And they know exactly what's going on, and they are highly amused, and there's some producers out there who get very angry that fan fiction writers write fan fiction, and then there are those who love it. The producers of Xena, producers of Buffy, the Marvel era people, they love that we write fan fiction. They love it.
Yeah, and you know, I was just thinking too, when you're talking about young writers, that's a great place to practice your craft and learn craft.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah,
it is. It's warm, and it's easy. You can make your mistakes, and you can screw up left and right. And there's people there who will help you. It's a very warm community.
Yeah. Well, that's I learned something important from those Sherlock episodes about endings. And in the case of the short story I wrote for Writers of the Future, I went back and I tried really hard to make people have to read the last half page a couple times so that they could put it together. And I think I must have succeeded in some part because it was accepted. But man, it's a lesson I think about a lot when I'm coming to the end of a book I'm reading, and I hope I can repeat that in my own writing because I love being haunted by a story.
Oh yeah. Yeah, and that goes for a lot of different things too, because one thing that is really interesting, books, movies, TV shows, if they grab you, it doesn't matter how they grab you. And I mean, how many times have you reread a Harry Potter because you're like, wait a minute, this fan theory is really interesting. Let me reread this chapter so I can see what they're talking about. I mean, that I read a lot of the stuff. I mean, I write fan fiction. I still do. I switch. I get bored.
Yeah.
Not that I get bored. I'm a fan of a show forever. Like, I'm a fan of Star Trek forever, Xena forever, now Miss Fisher forever. I mean, you get hooked. But you're as a fan fiction writer, you need to switch or you just get stale.
Sure. Sure.
That's how I started writing. I wrote before that, but I wrote fan fiction. That's how I started. That was my short stories. And then I started writing original short stories and then books. That was my path.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah, there's a lot of paths, and it's all about getting mileage on your pen and hopefully getting other people to reflect back to you what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
That's an important learning tool. I found a really funny, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. You found funny?
I was going to say another funny piece of fan fiction that I, or a fan theory that I encountered somewhere on the web was the theory about Jar Jar Binks being originally Lucas's, he was going to be the secret Dark Lord. And it's a very compelling argument. But people hated Jar Jar Binks so much after that show that people theorized that Lucas scrapped that and created another secret Dark Lord instead. If you have a chance, look it up. Jar Jar Binks, secret Sith Lord. And it's very funny.
Okay. It's amazing the things they come up with. I mean, there are times when, Joe Rawlings, he really pays attention to the fan theories. And a lot of times she'll say, oh, that's a cute idea. Oh, that's interesting. And that's about it. But other times she says, no way did that happen. Not in my universe.
Yeah, I can see how that might be important every now and
then. We're actually at 11 minutes. I want to give you lots of time to talk about your book and any events that you have coming. Do you want to talk about your current book or the next book that's coming out?
I can sort of talk about them a little bit together. I do have one event coming up this Thursday. That's 2 days from now. At the University Bookstore in Seattle, there's going to be a signing for Writers of the Future, the anthology. We'll be doing some readings, a couple of the writers, myself and John Lasser, and also one of the illustrators, because it's also Illustrators of the Future. So there's 12 young illustrators who also submit pieces of their work and are judged and then become part of the anthology. And they have them each illustrate one of the stories. There's 12 stories and 12 illustrators, and so each illustrator illustrates one of the stories and gets their work published in the anthology. So one of the illustrators will be there, Paul Otemi, and two writers, and we'll be signing and reading at the University Bookstore in Seattle about 7 o'clock this Thursday. June 30th, something like that.
Yeah, I think so.
I'll also bring copies of The Jack of Souls also, since the short story is kind of a prequel to the novel. the short story that's in Writers of the Future anthology. And the story is basically, it's the story of a young, I really like tricksters. I like to read fantasy about tricksters, about sort of the rogue character, the not, maybe not very strong, but very smart and clever, and someone who survives by their wits. And so I got a sort of an inspiration for that and created a character named Herrick, who was raised to be a kind of con artist and trickster by his mother, but who was also cursed to die on his 19th birthday by his mother. And his mom, you know, had some issues. And but the story starts with him on the eve of his 19th birth. And basically he's got about 12 hours, maybe at the outside, 24 hours to live. And he has no idea how to break this curse, or he would have done it by now. And he's got 12 hours to do it. So the story branches off from there, and he needs a lot of help to break the curse. And he manages to find some other outcasts like him who give him a little help, and they manage to keep him alive for a while. And but the story is him trying to finally work out from under the thumb of his mother's curse, and in the process kind of committing to some other things that may turn out to be even worse. So in other words, to break his curse, he might have to play around with some dark magic that he's going to have to live with after that. And then hence the next couple books with him, you know, trying to deal with that. And there's also a larger, much larger picture, of course, a much larger quest that's associated with one of the other outcasts that he hooks up with. And that's how the story unfolds. The second book is more about him dealing with the new dark magic that he's committed to. But the first one is him trying to get out from under the thumb of this curse. But I surround him with characters who are unlike him, you know, who are more of he is surrounded with knights and kind of bruisers who act as a foil for him. But also one of the things I really wanted to do is experiment with, you know, I really wanted a strong female lead. And so I created a character who they live in a very misogynistic society, and she really wants to become one of the queen's first knights. And, but the deck is stacked against her because of course she's a woman. And, yet she also has another thing she's dealing with. And that is, and I took this inspiration from Temple Grandin, who's, your listeners may know is a famous advocate for Asperger's and autistic neuroatypical people. She herself is neuroatypical and is brilliant. She's a animal behaviorist and works with horses and cows and all kinds of stuff to help the meat industry work and so on in a more humane way. Anyway, there was a wonderful movie, by the way, called Temple. That was who's the woman who played Princess Naboo or in Star Wars? Natalie? No, I can't remember. Anyway, it's a wonderful film about her, and I thought it would be. I would like to try to show a female Asperger's character. Of course, in this world, it's not modern world, so the word Asperger's doesn't exist. So I had to change it, but essentially, I wanted her to be neuroatypical, but with some of the real gifts that people like Temple Grandin have. So that, especially with animals, and as a knight, you're working with a horse all the time, so this could be a real asset. But on the other hand, there's, you know, with every magic or every ability must come some price, some cost. And so she really struggles with human social interactions in ways that she doesn't struggle at all with horses. And since this is a big part of being a knight, this is a problem for her. So So she, like the main character, Herrick, who has to struggle with, you know, his this new magic he's committed to, she has to struggle with this part of her personality that makes it really difficult for her to function in a court, like the court of the queen and so on. And I find that really interesting. I find autism and Asperger's to be such a fascinating kind of gift / struggle for people. And I have students, I'm a high school teacher, and I have students who I've worked with who show this kind of brilliance and struggle. And I thought it was worth trying to explore that in a character. So the female lead, Karis, is basically a kind of horse whisperer / Asperger's badass. And of course there's a romantic subplot that I borrowed from Midsummer Night's Dream. hilarity ensues.
Is there a pug?
Yes, there is. He comes along. He's wonderful. He's a little more. Puck was a little more truly chaotic. This character has agendas. Yes, but there is a Puck character. I don't want to spoil it. He's a spirit that is funny and mischievous and devious and
that's
a fun
Puck.
Character to play with. Yeah, yeah.
That's why every male actor would like to play them at least once when they're young.
So true. Yeah, I can see a female actor getting that role,
actually,
too.
Yeah, I was just thinking that. A female actress would be even better as Puck, actually.
Yeah, I can see that.
But I've actually never seen that. I'd love to see that on stage, a female Puck.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be... I wonder if Shakespeare had a male or a female play that since they... Or no, they had no female actors.
No,
they
had no women. They were all men.
Yeah. I wonder if they had the young... You know, the ones that played the females tended to be like boys that hadn't hit puberty yet. I wonder if that's what they had, if those are the people they had play Puck, or if he was a...
Yeah, I would think so. Because he's supposed to be like not male, not female in the play.
Yeah.
But it's always played by male. I mean, even the old movie from the 30s was Mickey Rooney.
I don't think I've seen that one. I'll have to check that out.
Oh, yeah. He was like 6-7 years old playing Puck.
Oh, my gosh. Oh,
mm-hmm.
my gosh. That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. In Midsummer's, it was, oh, my God. I can't remember. I mean, there was a lot of really famous MGM actors in that. But people, see, that's one of my little bugaboos. People miss out on so much not watching old movies, especially as a writer. There's so much there. I mean, I don't get it. I mean, one of my favorites, because I love mysteries as well as fantasy, and I love The Thin Man, and it's all in black and white. If you don't watch black and white, you miss half. You know, Citizen Kane is in black and white. I mean, some of the greatest movies ever made. Casablanca.
Yeah. The dialogue, especially. Don't you just love the dialogue? It's so witty. The banter. There's they spend a lot more time with dialogue, I think, back then.
And they had the best. Fitzgerald,
mm-hmm.
Hemingway. I mean, they all wrote movies. That's when it makes me, when somebody says, oh, well, I don't bother with black and white movies. And I'm like, you are so dumb.
Well, maybe when they're 80 and they have nothing else to do, they'll rediscover them. And I'm sure there's whole genres that I've neglected that when I'm 80, I can discover. I hope so, anyway.
Well, I'm not 80 and I watch it.
No, I don't mean that. I just mean that, you know, once I've stopped with all my enthusiasms, maybe I'll look around and realize there's whole other worlds of enthusiasms that I've missed out on. I can make up for lost time.
That's true. Sadly, we're at the end. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed the show.
Had a great time. It was nice to meet you, and thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry. Thank you.